I thought we would start by going over the answers for quiz one. I know that you don't have your quiz back, but at least you can start studying. So let's start with the mechanism problem first. I know that some of you are probably quite curious what is that final product of the first reaction. So you started out with a chiral alcohol. That you reacted with four reagents. First, PBr3. Second, I still gotta learn the name of that, but the sulfur equivalent of hydroxide, then sodium hydride, and then methyl bromide. So first portion of the mechanism, phosphorus tribromide. In this case, the oxygen attacks the phosphorus, kicking off a bromide in a process that looks kind of like SN2. Since I showed the full structure once, I can just say PBr2 to simplify my writing. We have an oxonium ion that's going to deprotonate. And then that OPBr2 is going to be kicked off by bromide. At this point, since this portion is like SN2, there is going to be inversion of stereochemistry. We now have an alkyl halide. Sulfur is a much better nucleophile than oxygen if you're comparing two molecules that are identical, other than the fact that they have sulfur versus oxygen. So this is very easily going to undergo an SN2 reaction. You might remember I hinted that maybe one of the things you might want to know is your SN1 and SN2 reaction. So this was an SN2. Which again undergoes inversion of configuration. Third step, sodium hydride. I had given the hint to remember that sulfur is in the same column as oxygen. So a sulfur-oxygen bond is going to act a lot like an oxygen-hydrogen bond. In fact, if I recall correctly, I think there's a weaker bond there, and so it's even easier to become deprotonated. So sodium hydride is going to pull that hydrogen off. Final reagent is methyl bromide. Not even a primary, it's less than that, it's just a methyl substrate. One of the best things to be attacked in an SN2 reaction. So sulfur attacks the carbon, kicking off the bromine. And there is our final product. Any questions about this mechanism? There will be, of course, partial credit for the couple of new people. I almost always have some partial credit I'm able to give, particularly on mechanism problems. Please don't ask me yet how much each one will be worth as far as each little type of mistake, because I have not started yet on grading, but there'll be partial credit. So last chance for questions on this one before we move to the second mechanism. All right, the second mechanism was oxidation using PCC and pyridine. Two comments. One, deuterium is not carbon. I say that because is this a primary, secondary, or tertiary alcohol? secondary, but I could tell just walking around and glancing at some papers, at least between the three different sections, some of you all accidentally interpret this as a tertiary alcohol because of there being three things attached to the carbon. But it's not just how many things are attached that determine whether it's primary, secondary, tertiary. It's how many carbons are attached. So since we only have two carbons that are attached, it's a secondary alcohol. Now, some of you asked during the quiz, you kind of gave me that, what do you mean you're not going to tell me? Look, when you asked, is this under anhydrous conditions? I said, I can't comment on that. Didn't need to, because whether you have anhydrous or aqueous conditions, you can't oxidize a ketone, or you can't oxidize a secondary alcohol past a ketone. So once you've gone through the reaction once, it's not going to do anything else unless you assumed there was water and unless you assumed a hydrate would form, which is possible, because if you listen carefully to when I said if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. So even though it's not likely for a hydrate to want to form, quite technically, if you had water around, the ketone that we're going to show forming here could react and make a hydrate, but that would not be the major product in a solution. And I'm addressing this because I'm thinking of test answers I've gotten in quarters past. So when you have an oxidation like this, if there's water around, you wouldn't need to show the hydrate formation unless it's really going to get over oxidized, because for most aldehydes and ketones, it's a fraction of percent of it that will at any one moment convert into the hydrate. So let's see the mechanism for this. You were supposed to show the full structure of the reagent once, so you needed to write out the full pyridinium chlorochromate. So there's the full molecule. The chromium gets attacked. Now we're still haven't addressed which version of the mechanism should you write, or are these different versions of the mechanism I've shown you equally valid? For the moment though, whichever version of the mechanism you showed of this attack was fine. For the thiochloride and for the tosyl chloride, I had shown a simultaneous sequence of steps to match what I presented in the lecture on this particular topic. I'm going to do it the same way I did in that lecture, show only the chromium oxygen bond opening first, and then the subsequent collapse of that and the expulsion of the chlorine. But what I'm trying to say is if you did it all in one, this first portion, it would have been fine. So one of the negatively charged oxygens collapses back to kick the chlorine off. Oh, and we do have pyridinium floating around as a counter ion. We still have the oxonium ion, so we'll have deprotonation. We now have the chromate ester, which is going to get deprotonated. Now, pyridine is generally the solvent used in this kind of reaction, or it's often added because it's the conjugate base of pyridinium. And so if you didn't want to have any potential for some strange form of side reaction, especially an acid-base one, it makes sense to have pyridine along with the pyridinium. And so many times when you see this mechanism, instead of the generalized B that I showed you all, it would be pyridine that would be the base that would remove the proton. Were you expected to show that? No. I'm just kind of completing the story a little bit. So pyridine can remove that deuterium. Deuterium's the same as hydrogen. It's just a different form of hydrogen. There would be a kinetic effect. In fact, there's what's called the kinetic isotope effect, which is where we could make some judgment about the mechanism of a reaction by replacing key hydrogen or hydrogens with deuterium and seeing how that would affect the reaction rate. Now, if we get time this quarter, we'll come back and more thoroughly cover that topic. But just want to point out that deuterium is just another form of hydrogen, and so even though you're going to have a different reaction rate, and that's because in this case, if you have a deuterium hooked up to a carbon, it's a heavier atom than hydrogen, it's got a different bond strength than just plain old hydrogen. But not enough different to drastically affect how it's going to react. So pull the deuterium off, the pair from the bond kicks back to the oxygen, which kicks off the chromium, and we end up with acetone. You did not have to show at all what happens to the chromium after the oxidation. Questions about either of these two problems? Shall we skip to the fill-in-the-blank problems first and then come back and hit nomenclature? So first fill-in-the-blank problem was related to SN2 again. Because you had a chiral alcohol reacting with something, then followed by sodium azide, in order to make a chiral alkyl azide. If this wasn't straight from the lecture, it practically was, because I remember talking when we first started reactions this quarter about the different ways of making leaving groups out of alcohols. And one method can lead to inversion of stereochemistry of an alcohol, which once it undergoes SN2 means you flip it back again, just like we had in the first synthesis problem. But there's another method, which is where you can have the stereochemistry retained. Now, two of the methods, making chloride from thionyl chloride and a bromide from PBr3, those cause an initial inversion, and then again, if you're doing SN2, you'll have a reinversion. Thionyl chloride in the Finkelstein reaction effectively preserves stereochemistry. In the case of thionyl chloride, it's because the carbon-oxygen bond doesn't get involved in the first place. And in the case of the Finkelstein reaction, is because usually, if you're starting with an alcohol, you first make a bromide, which causes inversion, and then you make the iodide, which again causes inversion. So, if you had something like tosyl chloride, which didn't change the stereocenter, then when you do SN2, you're going to get inversion, which means that's exactly what happened here, which means the answer to this problem tosyl chloride or mesyl chloride or any other sulfonyl chloride. Now, if you use tosic acid, won't work. Tosic acid won't do anything to alcohol except possibly dehydrate it if you're at high temperatures. So you might get partial credit if you put OH instead of Cl, but it won't work at all. You must have the chloride in order for that reaction to work. Yes? If what? Didn't I just say literally 15 seconds ago, if you put OH, you get partial credit? HCl? SOCl2. No, it'd be wrong, because the stereochem, no credit. Because that is the entire point of the question, is what is the stereochemistry? So that one problem is kind of all or nothing. Yeah.
I did say it, well,
your case, you don't have to worry about it. The class got a verbal announcement.
I realized I forgot to pass that on the after the fact, so don't worry in your case. Now, what about the second one? Second one was an alcohol reacting with tosic acid and heat. So, it is true that primary carbocations are terribly unfavorable. But you can, with enough heat and acid, dehydrate a primary alcohol. But if you are going to try to dehydrate this primary alcohol, there's going to be something interesting that happens. And no, you didn't have to write a mechanism to answer this question, but I'm going to write one to show what the answer is. So initially, protonation occurs. And again, with enough heat, you could drive water off, forming a carbocation. But yes, it is true that primary carbocations aren't favorable. But if we had an alkyl shift, couldn't we make a more stable carbocation? Now you might respond back and say, wait, no, what if we do a hydride shift? Because we get a hydride off of this tertiary position into the primary, that's going to make a tertiary carbocation. Yes, it is, but you got a four-member ring there. And you might remember that we did an example mechanism in class which involved a ring opening, which is exactly what would happen here. Once you have the ring open, then hydrogen can be eliminated. Making cyclopentene. Is there be partial credit for this? Yes, of course. How much? Don't ask me yet. Haven't graded yet. Questions? Yes. Question. Shall we do nomenclature now then? So first nomenclature question. Involved a diketone that has an alkoxide substituent. So now as far as which direction to number the chain from, well, if you started from the right-hand side, the alkoxide group gets a 2, but it's not the most important functional group. It's just a substituent. So the ketone's more important, which it would get a lower number if we start from the left. So we are, in fact, going to number from the left. Then, we do have a stereocenter, so let's figure out what's R and S. We have oxygen versus carbon with anything attached to it versus carbon with just hydrogens attached to it. So it's 1, 2, 3, so it is S. Since there's only one stereocenter, we don't need a number with that. We just say S. We have a single substituent, 5. Ethoxy. Then there's no other substituent, so we go to the main part of the name, hex. And, you know, I was hoping that I got this point across enough that we wouldn't have this mistake happen, but I've already seen it just looking at a couple people's papers. In all names, you have either A-N, E-N, or Y-N that is part of the name. You do not drop that, because it shows whether you have saturated or what kind of unsaturated hydrocarbon. So after hex, before the own, there is A-N. Has to be. Because there's two ketones, we're going to use an E there. So this is S5-ethoxyhexane-2,4-diol. Questions? Second problem then. This had an aldehyde and an alcohol. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. You might remember when we talked about ethers, I said ethers don't even have their own functional group ending. They are always just substituents. Now this next one. This next one got sections 1 and 2 yelled at. And I know I'm having kind of a colorful week here, but what got me was I said the same thing I said to your section, that I didn't write that position with a dash or wedge, and so that it is impossible to determine whether it's R or S. So I said, don't worry about that position when you're naming the compound. Person after person asked me, well, do we need to worry about stereochemistry? When would you not worry about stereochemistry? If you have stereocenters and you're naming a compound, when have I ever indicated it's fine not to mention the stereocenter? You will see sometimes structures written purposely ambiguously because it might not matter. In this case, it was just my mistake. It was an accident. I changed it at the last second before printing it out, and I forgot to put some stereochemistry in. But I know that you all get in test panic mode sometimes, but try to think through before you just react. When I say, and especially when I say, just ignore this one stereocenter, and what comes across in your brain is, oh, don't even look at stereochemistry. So just try, again, I can't fault you in some sense, you're in quiz panic mode, but anyways. So there's only one nameable stereocenter here. Let's figure out its configuration. And you didn't have to write it out fully. Hopefully you realized this one pretty quickly, but it does require the use of phantom atoms, because we do have a double bond there. So effectively, on the left-hand side, we have oxygen, oxygen, hydrogen, because of the doubling of the double bond that we do. And then on the right-hand side, we have oxygen, carbon, hydrogen. Well, oxygen-oxygen hydrogen is more important than oxygen-carbon hydrogen. So the aldehyde is more important than the alcohol, than the methyl group. So this is R. We have two substituents. The substituents are named in alphabetical order. Once you have substituents, there's no priority order. It's numerical order. So the H in hydroxy comes before the M in methyl. This is a 4-carbon compound, so it's butanal. Now, last nomenclature problem had a little of everything on it, except an alkene or an alkyne, which I did on purpose. I wanted to focus just on some of the new naming things that we got. So this was to see if you remember that an aldehyde is more important than a ketone, and therefore the ketones are named as oxo as substituents. So there's a total of three substituents on this molecule. Notice there's a functional group in every position. So this also was to see if you recognize that because the aldehyde's more important, that's where the numbering starts. Remember that prefixes like di, tri, tetra don't get alphabetized. So this compound is 4-hydroxy-2,3-dioxo-butanol. And the D in di doesn't get alphabetized. That's why the O in oxo still comes second. Questions on that problem? Yes? I'll have to find out. I need to go to the IUPAC guide to see if it's allowable. Other questions? All right. We started with discussing epoxides. Last time, I believe, we did a cationic ring opening and an anionic ring opening. I'd like to just review those briefly and say a little bit more detail about each of those. First, are there any questions about synthesizing epoxides? We covered MCPBA as one way to do it. We also talked about making a halohydrin as an intermediate to get to an epoxide. Did anybody have any questions about those syntheses? All right, then cationic ring opening. Won't show mechanism again, but I want to write out how would you represent those reagents by synthesis? Because the questions also come up, what conditions should I list for this type of reaction? Well, if it's cationic, what's one of the things that you've got to have around? An acid catalyst, that's right. And so tosic acid is usually going to be the one I suggest to use. What else also goes with this? What types of compounds would be used in the ring opening? Alcohols, or technically what else could be used? What's the smallest non-carbon alcohol? Non-carbon. Water. Water acts much like an alcohol, doesn't it? It's got an OH group. It only has a hydrogen besides that, but that's why it does react like an alcohol. So we'll say ROH or H2O. I'll show the product as if it was ROH. Focusing on the regiochemistry, which, if it is an alcohol, we not water that we use, if it is an alcohol we do this with, where will the OH group, when the ring opens, end up? On the more or the less substituted carbon? The OH group, less substituted position. Well, remember the intermediate that gets formed here. We have a oxonium ion that has to get pushed open. And part of our discussion the other day was which part of the ring is going to open up. Now, I had directed your attention to last quarter's reactions of bromination, where we form a cyclobromonium ion, and then oxymercuration, demercuration, where we form a cyclomercurinium ion. Has anybody gone back to review those reactions to study why one bond versus the other breaks? And does anybody have any questions about why is it that one bond in that ring versus the other breaks? If you haven't come up with that kind of question yet, you need to review, because now I am going to go back and decide whether we are going to delay the test today because the quiz got delayed today. But I have not officially changed that yet, so that does mean you all need to be studying, because when is the exam scheduled currently? Tuesday of next week, right? That means we only have today and Friday for you to be asking questions, so. Oh, that's right, for your section it didn't. It's the other section that's now about to start begging and pleading that we delay. So, assuming that nothing gets changed, well, then your section's not affected at all. So you have tomorrow to ask me those questions. So I hope you do go back and review. I'll state one more time what's going on here. That this ring is unstable, and unlike the way I've drawn it, this is deceptive, it's not an equilateral triangle. One side is not the same length as the other. And that's because the more substituted carbon does a better job at handling a positive charge if the positive charge forms. Now, there is stereochemical evidence to show that that ring doesn't open ahead of time. And I know I'm not writing this part down, because I probably won't ask a question like this, but just to fill in a little bit of information, how do we know that that ring doesn't open by itself? Well, if it did, you really would form a carbocation, which means two things could happen. Carbocation rearrangement, and the carbocation could be attacked from either face. Well, we don't see that in the product mix, or at least not appreciably, which means that that ring stays a ring until something comes and pushes the ring open. So then we have to go back and say, well, why would it end up attacking at the more substituted position? Because if something's attacking at the same time the ring's opening, that feels like an SN2 reaction. And in SN2 reactions, kinetics controls the reaction, right? Attack at a primary position is much faster for SN2 than a secondary or tertiary position. Well, that's because this is not a normal SN2 case. That ring is so strained that really it's like if you were to imagine you had an oxygen connected by two rubber bands to two carbons over there, and you pull on that oxygen. Well, what if one of the rubber bands is weaker than the other? Then if you have something that's going to come along and possibly interact with one of those rubber bands, well, the weaker one's going to be the one that likely breaks, right? Same thing here. The left-hand bond to the more substituted position is longer and weaker because if you had that bond break, the carbocation that forms would be more stable. So that's why we end up with this form of regiochemistry. How is everything different with the anionic reaction? Well, what would I write down, not for mechanism, but for synthesis? Alkoxide, okay. Acid and alkoxide, in that order. So alkoxide and then acid. Do I need a 1-2? Yes, I absolutely do. Because an alkoxide and an acid would react to make alcohol and never touch the epoxide ring. Unless you have more acid, then you're back to a cationic ring opening. So what you got to show is an alkoxide or hydroxide reacting with the ring followed by H+. But notice what I'm going to say here. Not tosic acid. Tosic acid would work. It would do nothing wrong. But it's a waste. Because the reason we normally use tosic acid is an acid catalyst, meaning that we need just a small quantity of H+. So literally, if for those of you who cook with by eyesight, where you just do a pinch of that and a handful of that, it's kind of like doing chemistry that way. You just get a little pinch of tosic acid, throw it in, that's good enough. Here, after the first step of the reaction, you use an alkoxide to make an alkoxide. When the ring gets popped open, I'm just realizing here, you're looking at this like, Dr. Gray, you forgot something. It's not alkenes reacting, it's epoxides that were acting. Sorry about that. So, you pop the ring open using an alkoxide. That would make an alkoxide because of the oxygen that just opened. So you have to neutralize it with acid. Well, why use tosic acid to do neutralization? But you need to still be careful what acid you use, because we're soon going to start seeing what happens when we have multiple functional groups. So let's say that I threw strong, concentrated sulfuric acid at this. It might work in this case, but what if there's an alkene on the molecule as well? Well, then that alkene could react. So you in real life, you would use a very dilute solution of acid so that it just barely neutralizes everything without causing some kind of side reaction. So you just got to, and that's something to think about as we go into the future. For just discussing regiochemistry, again, if I imagine an alkoxide reacts, it's sterics that control the reaction. So now you will get substitution at the less substituted position. And so the OH group gets pushed to the more substituted position. Now, this is not quite reality. Epoxides actually have a little bit more complicated behavior than this. But I don't believe that yours is one of the textbooks that actually gets into that topic. I got to go back and read it my own self. But many textbooks carefully have problems designed where the epoxide you're choosing between a primary and a tertiary center. And there is some squirrely behavior that can happen when you have a secondary center versus a primary. For this class, for this level of OCHEM, I'm going to ignore all those subtleties. So what I've presented is good enough for us. But if you go to other textbooks, you will find something that may partially contradict what I've shown you. But that's just the same type of sequence of expanding lies that we teach in chemistry anyways. You know, we say, here's what an atom looks like, until the next class where we said, no, that's not what it looks like, and here's what it looks like. And then you go take physics and, oh, those chemists don't know anything. This is what an atom looks like. Same type of thing I'm doing here. Now, there's two other reagents that do this anionic ring opening that I want to show you. One of those reagents is lithium aluminum hydride. So if you had an epoxide, and this time I really will write an epoxide. Synthetically, you'd write it lithium aluminum hydride followed by acid workup. Mechanistically, we're going to keep the simplified mechanism for hydrides that I've shown so far. After the exam, I'm going to show you a bit more complete mechanism involving reducing agents. So for right now, we're still just going to say a plain H minus gets involved. It attacks, pushes open the ring. And notice, there's now only one functional group that results, the alcohol. Since the second step is the addition of acid, I'm allowed to show H plus here. And this is a reduction, because previously both carbons were connected to the oxygen, so both carbons used to have higher oxidation states. But on the end carbon, oxygen got replaced by hydrogen, so its oxidation state goes down by 2. Mechanistically, though, it's the same as you saw above. It's just hydrogen instead of hydroxide or alkoxide. One other reagent that behaves very similarly, and I show you this because we are leading up to doing more complete multi-step synthesis, where we can especially make larger molecules by trying to make carbon-carbon bonds. And there's a sneaky way we could add a carbon-carbon bond here. And that's using an acetylide ion. You might remember these from last quarter when we discussed the acidity of alkynes, the fact that an alkyne hydrogen is more acidic than an alkene one that's more acidic than an alkane. So relatively easier to deprotonate an alkyne, but you still make something that's really basic. Anybody happen to recall what the average pKa value of an alkyne is? I think I heard it already. 25. Right. What about an alcohol? 16 to 18. So if you deprotonate an alcohol and deprotonate an alkyne, alkyne's more basic. So if you can get an alkoxide to pop this epoxide ring open, the point of what I'm trying to get at here is this will also pop the ring open.
Notice the comment I've made here about being careful with the way that you draw triple bonds. I've circled the carbon the new bond got made to. And notice, therefore, I have a line going from the triple bond to that carbon. That's because on either side of the triple line, both of those positions are carbons themselves. If I did not draw the connector, then what I really would have been showing is this carbon being replaced by that carbon. And that's not what happens. You form a bond there. But for some reason, just because of the odd way that triple bonds look, it often confuses students writing answers down. So just be careful to note that I have done this correctly. If you count, one, two carbons there, one, two carbons there. The one thing I did leave off is my R group. But otherwise, I've done the bond drawing correctly. In real life, you would do the as a 1-2, where you do the acetylide ion first, and then H plus following afterwards. So you finish up exactly the same way. And we don't have an awful lot of time left, but I want to show you an example synthesis problem. And this is something that we did in the other sections as well. And this is leading up to our synthesis workshop. Now, I know we have thiols and sulfides that we're supposed to discuss, but I kind of made an executive decision that since we're a little behind, I'm going to work in those functional groups where I can. Now, there's not a heck of a lot we end up doing with them anyways, but since the book does discuss them, I want to discuss them at least briefly. But to get ready for Friday, I'll show you a little bit differently than I did for the other sections because I want to make you a little more worried, I guess. Oh, in fact, I'll take it one step further because we have a few more minutes than the other section did. Yeah. There we go. What is this? Well, this is what something on your final would look like. Not your first exam, your final. But where you're given a carbon fragment, in this case, just an alkane. And you have to provide the sequence of steps that would be able to convert that alkane into the target product. All right? How in the world are we going to get between the two? Okay, so someone suggested we need to make an alcohol, we need to make an alkene. Do you know any reaction to make an alcohol or an alkene directly from an alkane? What is the one and only reaction you've learned to convert an alkane into anything useful? Free radical halogenation, that's right. This is part of the reason for your flashcards, because so far all you've been just terrified about is learning reagents and learning mechanisms. But there's one more layer of complication you have to add on to it, which is, what do you use the reaction for? To make a kind of weak analogy, so far, if we were painters, we've been worried about how do you make the paint. But we haven't done any painting yet. That's the transition we're making here. We've learned all these reactions, but so what? I can show you 100 reactions. What do you do with them? You make molecules. So, the one and only reaction you know is free radical halogenation. Bromine and light. Bromine because it's more selective than chlorine, and you'll get mainly the more substituted bromide. Do we know any reaction that could take that bromide to an alcohol? SN2. Do we know any reaction that could be made to make an alkene? E2. Do we know any reaction that could make an alkyne? Well, not directly, but if we did do an E2 reaction to make the alkene, didn't we have a two-step process that we learned to go from an alkene to an alkyne? The answer is yes. Bromine without light or water to make the vicinal dihalide. A double elimination with sodium amide gave us the alkyne. Notice, so all these things we're doing so far just have three carbons in them. But somehow we end up with a product with six carbons. Well, didn't I show you in the step right up above a way of making a new carbon-carbon bond? By using an alkyne to attack an epoxide? Well, I could get an epoxide if I took the same alkene and in a separate pot from the bromine reacted it with MCPBA. This is an example of what you would call divergent synthesis, where your reaction pathway splits. You take one substance and use it two different ways. All right, now an alkyne won't directly react with an epoxide. First, we have to deprotonate it, which we could use yet another sodium amide to do that deprotonation. Now, if we simply take those two compounds, the epoxide and the acetylide ion, we could do what's now called convergent synthesis. Where you separately make two complicated molecules and then at the last moment throw them together to make an even more complicated molecule. Initially we have an alkoxide, which if we use dilute, that's what DIL stands for in this case, dilute H+, we can make an alcohol. But that's not what the product is supposed to be. It's supposed to be an alkene. A cis alkene. Which means the last step is Lindler's catalyst and hydrogen. Now, you could study this and say, okay, each one of those steps makes sense. How in the world am I supposed to know to do that whole thing, though? Well, we've got 8.5 more weeks for you to practice. But this is where we're going to go, especially after the first exam. Now, questions? How do I put the two bromines on there? That's what Br2 does. It's bromination without light. So, do you happen to have a date offhand that you could find quickly for that reaction? Because you floored me how quickly you did that the other day. It is one of the reactions we learned towards the middle of Chem 12A, probably the 7th week or something like that. It would have been about the same time as the oxymercuration reaction. Actually, that would have been the same dates you quoted the other day, because that's the same
exactly the thing, same thing we were discussing, the bromine, the cyclobromonium intermediate. Did you find it again?
It is
11:13? 30. So if you look up the lecture from 11:30 from last quarter, it has this topic on it. We're out of time for today, so we're going to do more synthesis problems, little synthesis problems, to get you ready for the exam. Yes? Question is, could I use sodium hydride here? I gotta go check and see what the pKa of hydride is. My gut instinct says yes. Why would you use this instead? I better go find out. I haven't been asked that before.